the realization I came to was that I'm sad and I'm crying about stuff because I'm grieving the concept that my family is like a healthy family unit, or that it was getting there. Growing up in America, clearly I went home with some kind of expectation of how like the grieving process would look, and it didn't look like that for me. So I want people to know that, like, if it hasn't happened to you yet, to be a little bit mentally prepared. And if it has happened to you, that you're not alone, that it doesn't match what media told us it's supposed to look like, especially specifically for non-white Americans.
Heyo, welcome to the Asian Detox Podcast, the podcast where we boldly reclaim Asian American prosperity. We have relatable conversations about how being Asian American shows up in our day-to-day lives, how money is deeply embedded in our culture, and how you can choose to define your own version of success in a world that tries to tell us how to be. I'm your host, TJ Wei, your hashtag very Asian, non-binary, gluten and dairy-free money habits coach, and I want you to know that you don't have to live in the boxes other people put you in. You can design your abundant life in a way that honors your heritage while enjoying a life of ease and alignment. And you can do it while making money and building generational wealth.
Have you ever traveled back to your family after a prolonged period of being away, only to come back feeling like you were walked back into like a totally different world, or you were surrounded by people who just don't understand you, or you just don't fit in with? This year, TJ, an Asian who grew up in America, had to travel back to his family when their grandmother passed away. As a very close friend of TJ, I added that very close, I don't know if it stands, but as a very close friend of TJ's, I witnessed her go through a wide array of emotions, including frustration, all while trying to process the death of her grandmother. Hi everyone, I'm Hannah Pillow, the host of Releasing the Shits podcast, and today I will be interviewing TJ on the podcast, exploring this journey of unraveling that occurred during the trip back to the family. Hi, TJ. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for doing this, Hannah.
Yeah, of course. I think we had a great conversation pre-production, so I thought it would be just good to repeat that in a recording.
Yeah, definitely. So for the audience, I had been struggling with recording this episode as a solo episode, and Hannah, who is also my podcast producer, talked me through it, and we decided that it would actually be a more dynamic conversation rather than me just talking at the mic. Because personally for me, if I am just talking to the mic, it's so easy to kind of hide parts of the story that I'm not necessarily uncomfortable sharing, but that like wouldn't come out unless I was talking to somebody else. So we decided to use this format instead.
Yeah, definitely. I think that sometimes when we're telling a story, I know I do this a lot, basically. When I tell a story, I leave out chunks of the story just because my brain knows that that happened and understands the context. But the person listening to me is like, I think you just like skipped over something there. What? Let's rewind.
Yep. There's a lot of assumptions made when you're just talking to yourself.
Exactly. Amazing. Well, let's dive in. It's a very touchy subject today, so let's dive straight into it. TJ, I want you to start by describing your relationship with your grandmother to us. This was your paternal grandmother, right?
Yes. So my grandmother on my dad's side, actually both my grandparents on my dad's side, actually moved from Taiwan to California when I was, I think even before I was born, and stayed with my parents through my early childhood. And so grandma was kind of like the in-house babysitter for when both my parents were at work and I wasn't in preschool. She would like walk me across the street to the preschool and things like that. And I would play like games with them. And I honestly don't have a single negative memory of my grandmother, like of my interactions with her. I don't have a single negative memory. The only place where there might be like some tension is actually that my mother, who is like their in-laws, right? My mother didn't have a good relationship with her. So she would actually like talk to me and my brother about how like evil that side of my family was, that like there was bad blood there, and like they were inherently evil and they owed her some kind of thing. So the only negative associations I have are based off of whatever my mom would tell me.
Yeah, and that's a tricky place to be as a child being molded, right? But I remember you telling me that you didn't actually believe your mom because of your interactions. Well,
it was like, I don't know that I didn't believe some of the things she said, but it was more that like I knew as a kid that she was basically accusing half of my blood of being bad. And I'm like, excuse me, that's not okay for you to say to me because you just told me that I'm bad based off of this assumption.
You got bad blood. It's like, I'm going into Taylor Swift mode now.
Yeah, yes.
Family dynamic like that. I think we're more aware of it now, but I think back then, parents tended to be a lot more open about being so vocal about these family politic issues in front of the kids.
Yes.
Which in some cases can be very confusing because it's very conflicting messages talking about people you love in most cases, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're going to get to it at the end about how our parent brain is shaped. So let's save that.
Yes.
But let's go back. You had a great relationship with your grandmother. I totally feel that. I love that you said you don't have any bad memories of your interactions with her. I totally feel that. So when you first learned that she passed away, how did you feel and what did you need to do?
Yeah, so she had been sick. She had cancer and a couple other complications, and she'd actually been in the hospital like 5 days before. But that was like on a Friday. And then on Monday, she got released from the hospital, and my mom was like, oh, she looks fine. She'll like, there's nothing wrong. Like, don't worry about it, because I was trying to plan like a visit. And then on Wednesday, I found out she had passed. So basically I got this message of like, everything's fine. In fact, I had like called grandma and she's like, don't worry about anything. It's all good. Like she totally put on a brave face. And so on Wednesday, even though she'd been sick, it was a shock. I was running an executive meeting and my dad called me and I just flipped my phone over because I was in the middle of working. And then I checked my phone afterwards and there was a text from my mom telling me that grandma had passed. And I was like, shit, what do I do? Like, I'd been through this process before of like, my grandfather passed while I was in Arizona as well. And I remember like, I had to step out of a meeting then and tell my boss and then go like arrange a flight and then go home and pack. And it was like, I couldn't do any of that. I was frozen. Like, the best I could do was text some of my coworkers and be like, hey, my grandma just passed and it hasn't hit me yet. Like, it didn't feel like I was able to process yet. And I kept trying to go book a flight. And my brain was like, I don't even know what to do. Like, I couldn't, like, there were too many options and I couldn't figure out when I needed to go home or like how to pick the best options and stuff. So I ended up having to just like, I know I reached out to you and Renee and then I was like, okay, I just need to sit here and like cry first before I can really do anything else. Except I couldn't even cry. Like, it was really hard.
Oh, yeah. Wow. You couldn't cry. Was that something that's normal for you, TJ? Like, is it difficult for you to cry or is it just the circumstances?
It might have been that it was like the middle of the day and we're in Arizona, like super bright and sunny. Like, normally if I'm crying, it's because like I'm watching something sad or it's the like I'm in my bedroom in the dark. So it might have been like that. The environment didn't seem like a crying situation because I do remember the day that I went to go fly out, I actually have a little like cubby under the stairs in my house and I went and sat in there and then I could cry. Like I posted on Facebook about what had happened and I was like processing and then I cried there. So it might be like that I don't like to cry in the sun.
That makes sense. So you went to your Harry Potter cupboard and cried.
Yes.
That makes sense too. And I'm glad that you got that cry out. You had that, but we all know that's not the end of it, right? We have that cry and it lingers, it stays on. The grieving process is not a, let me just sit and cry it out and it's done and dusted. That's not how it works, right? So before I ask the next question, I was going to ask you, where does your family stay that you had to travel back to and where are you currently?
Yeah, so I'm in the Phoenix, Arizona area, and then my family is in the California Bay Area. So it's like a 2-hour flight plus like the time to get to the airport and go through security. So it's not far, but I pretty much only go home once a year.
Oh, okay. Wow. And that's interesting because I live in South Africa and I try to go home once a year from England. That is a trek. Yeah. I love that you're 2 hours away and go once a year. That is great. I had to move a lot further to do that. Okay, great. So before we speak about traveling back to your family for the funeral and what unfolded for you, can you tell us a little bit about what your relationship with your family is like from afar?
Yeah.
I'm saying afar now, but now that you said 2 hours, I'm like, okay, yeah,
it's still
afar.
Like, it's enough distance, right? Like, that was I moved out here to go to college and it was like enough that I had the space, but also that my mom, like, as the baby of the family, my mom didn't like have a freak out that I was so far away, because I did have a full ride to Oklahoma, which I've never been to. And being in Arizona was more comfortable for my parents' peace of mind, which also, like, in my head means that they'll nag me less, right? They won't worry as much, because in the worst case emergency, it's a 2-hour flight or like a 13-hour drive. So it reduces the amount of tension in the family to be at least like in a decent distance from them. But post-college, my interactions with my family, there was a time where I didn't talk to them actually for a couple of months because they like messed up my birthday. And now it used to be like weekly phone calls. Now it's been spaced out a little bit more, just kind of organically. So it's almost like if I call them, they expect me to have like a question or need something from them at this point.
Wow. Okay.
Especially because they're both retired. Now it's kind of like if I call them too often, they have nothing to tell me or talk about. So before my grandmother passed, that was basically the main update. How is grandma doing? Because first of all, grandma's a little hard of hearing, and then it would have to be in Chinese and my Chinese sucks. So I have to ask my parents about it.
So there's no like huge, like, do you feel like you need to speak to them every week, or do you feel like you want to? There's no like emotional need for that for you from your side, is there?
No, I don't have a need, mostly because I don't expect a super supportive conversation to happen. I don't have a lot, like, I'm not the type that needs to share everything with them. Like, mostly if I need to share something, it's like, oh, I got a new like job, right? Or it's like things that line up to like the achievement category, or hey, my washer broke and I need some help. Like, those are the two categories of things that are easy to share with them. Other stuff of like how I'm doing emotionally, or if I don't like to tell them I'm traveling because my mom still got COVID brain and she doesn't want, like, she still feels like it's unsafe for me to go places. And so there's really not much to talk about on both ends, just because I'm avoiding tension.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. Yeah, I totally relate to that. And especially what you say about if you call too often, there's not much to talk about. You know, I try to call my grandfather, the only one who's still alive. I try to call him at least once a week, but I do find like it becomes more difficult to find things to talk about because you have to be so selective as well of what you say and what you talk about. But I love to point out before we go to the end of the episode and explain this, but what you described about calling your parents for achievement-based things is very much the adaptive child brain.
That's true. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so now we got the idea. We've got the context. Your relationship with your family is not that emotional. That's not that emotional bond that you don't expect that support from them,
mm-hmm.
right? So bearing that in mind, can you paint us a picture of what happened when you entered your family home and like what unfolded?
Yeah. So I remember like my parents picking me up from the airport and dad gets out to like help me with my suitcase. And normally it's my mom that gets out and like wants a hug. And I actually, the last couple of times she hadn't. So didn't get a hug from mom. And I actually don't remember if I hugged dad, but I'm pretty sure I would have, given the circumstances that it was his mom that had passed. It was weird. I want to say that it wasn't quite as if I had gone home for a funeral. Like, everything was kind of like business as usual for a trip home, of like unpacking and talking and stuff. The only thing is like logistically, hey, like talking through which of my other relatives were in town yet and what the plan was for the next day, stuff like that. But the weekend was definitely different. Once, like, whenever we went to go to, so my grandmother has a separate townhouse that she lived in, and my aunt was staying with her like the past year or so. So we went to that townhouse, and that atmosphere was different because suddenly it was like, we didn't used to like talk about old stories, like family stories or family history much when I visited before. But this time, like all the strangest stories like fell out. You're just like, wait, like I had to wait till grandma died to hear these stories, what happened here. And it was like an atmosphere of taking care of business, of, hey, we're going to sort out some stuff that logistically grandma's clothes or jewelry or the photo albums. There was a lot of like kind of keeping busy to not be grieving was the way I interpreted it. But it's like a little different than what I would expect of focusing on grieving first and then doing the logistical things. Like, because in Taiwan, where my family grew up, there's no such thing as like an inheritance or a will or anything like that. You just divvy your parents' shit up when they die. So they were just doing that. And there was like no clear place to pause until we actually had the funeral. And that's when like all the tears came out. And I remember we were taking turns going up to the coffin to say goodbye to grandma. And dad came back from his turn and he was looking for a hug. But my brother and my mom thought he wanted a tissue. And I was like, first of all, I know that man always has a handkerchief, so he's not asking for a tissue. But I was like behind my mom and my brother. So I had to be like, you idiots, he wants a hug. Like, what are you doing? And so that was probably the most touchy-feely I'd ever seen my family.
So it's like that was their way of offering support, right? They figured that your father needed something. They didn't quite get what he needed, but
yes,
they figured he needed something and they were trying to help in some way.
Yeah. But I think it's just like also how little we view the emotional support aspect as like something that we need, especially out of dad. Like there's a mental image, right? Of like, this is like honestly the first time I remember seeing him cry and all of that stuff. But yeah, so it was definitely different than the normal experience to me.
I love that he cried because I didn't make it home for my grand's funeral. So I got the play-by-play from my brother. WhatsApp messages.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Not at the actual funeral. He gave it to me the next day.
Okay.
Yeah. And because I was the day of the funeral, I was like in bed crying the whole day. And I couldn't make it home anyway because she died in the hospital. And the Muslim culture is they have the funeral like immediately after the...
Oh.
Yeah. So I couldn't even make... And plus it was COVID time, I believe, as well, that all this happened.
Mm.
But yeah, the play-by-play I got is that all the women were crying and like really breaking down, but none of the men cried, which is quite a normal display in our family. So I think it's quite refreshing that your dad did shed tears in front of the family. Good on him.
Yeah. I mean, it was basically all family, right? Like if we'd said, hey, we're going to have a larger ceremony and invited her neighbors and stuff, that they would have showed up. But they decided they wanted like a family only funeral. So I think that helped. Like if they were strangers, then I don't know that they would have been able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think my grandfather probably did cry. Oh my God, that was a love story for another time. But yeah, so what kind of happened after that? Like, what did you observe of your family that really got you so frustrated? Because I remember there was like a ton of messages coming in from you at that time, and there were so many emotions.
So because my mom didn't have a good relationship with my dad's side of the family, and my grandma died 2 days after my mom's birthday. So grandma had been sick, and so they didn't really celebrate my mom's birthday. And my mom kept going like, oh, I haven't even gotten my cake yet, which the woman has diabetes. So I'm kind of like, oh, you don't need a cake.
Okay,
but she basically wasn't a supportive wife or mother. And like I said before, like I didn't expect support from her. Like I didn't expect her to be a supportive mom in this situation. But I guess I kind of still expected her to be a supportive wife.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen. And not only was it like, oh, it just didn't happen, it was like the opposite of happening, right? Like she was nagging about like divvying up grandma's stuff or I guess there was a conversation before my grandma passed that uncle was the one that like should be paying for like all the meals and the services and stuff for whatever reason. And in her head, it's like they owe it to my family that he pays for stuff because he's the only one without kids. So I, and like he's the baby of that generation and stuff like that. So that was like the only part of any conversation she paid attention to is who was paying for shit. So she was like, even before we went into the funeral home, she was being like, uncle has to pay for this. And dad had to be like, can I have one day to be sad and not have to deal with your drama?
And he said that out loud.
Well, the first half of it, yes. Can I have one day to be sad? Yes. I'm not sure he knows the word drama. I don't know. Who knows?
Okay. Is there not a Chinese word for drama?
I'm sure there is, but I don't know it, honestly.
Okay. Fair enough.
So, like, when I say I don't think they know words, it's because they've never used it in front of me, right? Like,
gotcha.
And dad had been, like, kind of acting like he was fine, but there was clear tension. Like, his fuse was super short, and he kept expecting, like, some more reverence from how we handled grandma's stuff and things like that. And there's not much structure to their lives. So when mom is kind of, like, not able to follow along when my dad expects structure, then it's kind of, like, just the phase of their life that they're in. But there were a lot of incidents that the way my mom handled it that was like, I'll skip the after funeral lunch. But for dinner, we got home and like the expectation was we were going to eat in and somebody was going to cook. And in my head, that was like, oh, mom will cook. So it was like 2 hours after I would have expected us to eat, which is like a very fluid dinner time anyway. Like dinner time ranges from like 5:30 to 8 p.m. So it wasn't such a big deal. But it was like, I was starting to get hungry. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to cook. Like, forget it. And I go down to the kitchen and my dad is also in the kitchen going, what should we make for dinner? And I'm like, oh, it's just the two of us. So we made food. And then mom finally comes down and she's like, happy that I cooked. She's like, oh, it's the first time I ate anything that my daughter cooked, because I haven't talked to them about the non-binary thing. And that was like a weird dinner conversation, because then she went on about how like the only two instances she understands about like Western grieving culture is that, and she kept calling it a party, but like the concept of when you're grieving, like during a wake or something, that the extended family or friends will bring food to your wake and contribute in like a potluck style. And her only two examples was when a coworker who also happened to be a neighbor had something like that. And then also, like, I think it's from like Sixth Sense, where the little girl got poisoned and the family was grieving and they're all in the family home together. And like, to her, those were like the two examples of how Westerners handle funerals, which in my brain, I'm like, how can that be your only examples, first of all? But like, she didn't understand the concept. And I was trying to explain to her that in Western culture, when you're grieving, there's not a soul in your life who expects you to be capable of taking care of yourself. Like if you are the primary griever, nobody expects you to be able to cook for yourself. They expect you to be catatonic and crying the entire time. So they bring you food because that's the way, like they bring flowers and food and help you like do the chores because they don't expect you to be a functioning human during that time frame. And I'm sitting here explaining that to her and I'm like, this is stupidly ironic because dad is the primary griever. And here he had to cook his own dinner, right? Like there were three other adults in the house that could have done it. And I had to explain this after the fact of like, people don't expect you to be able to adult in this entire time that I've been observing. Dad has been the primary griever and the primary adult because he's the eldest son. So there was a lot of like, this is super weird that this is business as usual. And it was kind of like, yeah, because in Asian culture, because we don't like to process our emotions, we just do. Like, we keep ourselves busy. It was so unheard of for my mom that, like, you wouldn't do anything while you're grieving. And I was like, yeah, because all of you are hiding your emotions. So it's better to not take your, like, chores away from you. It's better to not volunteer to do things on your behalf because you need something to keep you busy. And for two retired adults, the house chores are kind of the only thing to do.
Right. Gotcha. So I just want to go back a little bit here. So you mentioned that your mom was not was confused with the culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what culture was she used to? What happens?
Yeah. So I think about it now, and my mom is the fourth of five children in her family. So her experience with when her parents passed was that she would like fly home, and her elder siblings would already be like taking care of a lot of the arrangements and stuff. And that culture is basically like, because I don't remember if I wasn't there for a funeral, but I think they cremated my grandmother. Like they have incense and they bow and they pray and stuff like that. But I think in her experience, it was basically just the act of divvying shit up, like going through the old things and saying, like, who does this go to or what would be fair? And I feel like that might partly be just because she's like the younger of the family. So she didn't have a lot of responsibilities associated to it. So I really like don't know what her experience was like when her parents passed, other than like when she was with me, she had been crying a lot. But at the time we found out about my grandmother, we were in Great Britain. We were on vacation after my cousin's wedding. So there's like not much to compare to, because it's not like she had anything to keep her busy. So like all she could do was be sad.
Yeah. And it's interesting that she couldn't like go back and empathize that that was her experience and this is what's happening now.
I worry. Because, like, part of me goes, like, she should be able to, and I know she's capable, but, like, the other part is, like, what if there's resentment there, right? That, like, I remember she was upset that me as, like, an 11-year-old wasn't as sad as she was about her mom passing.
Well.
And this is a woman I met, like, once for Christmas when I was, like, five. So I had no concept, of course, of even, like, death. That was the first relative I had that died, and we're on vacation in an unknown space, and like I was sad about other shit, but I wasn't crying all the time about it. And my mom like resents when people around her aren't as sad or angry as she is, so I worry that like she carried that forward into my dad's side of the family's like grieving process.
That's really interesting when you look at the child and parent brain of that situation.
As a first-generation Asian American, I grew up trying to fit into the boxes other people put me in. I considered acting, voice acting, and writing as career options when I was little, but ended up joining corporate America as an IT project manager to take the Asian parent-approved path. The good news is, it's not too late for me to follow those more creative goals, but I didn't have the energy to work both my corporate job and follow those passions. And I couldn't shake the cultural directive to be financially stable so that my parents wouldn't have to worry about me. It's so ingrained in me that it's difficult to focus on more creative pursuits or what might be considered passion projects without the financial backing to support myself. That's why I'm such a big fan of building systems and financial foundations that leverage my hashtag very Asian frugal money habits and the more expansive abundance mindset that I strive to embody every day. While sitting at my corporate job feeling like there must be more to life than this, I spent years learning and absorbing information about how to become financially independent, invest in real estate and stocks, and build a business. And now, I'm on track to retire by 40. But more than that, I have the freedom to dress how I want, because how I dress now is certainly not considered professional, adopt unconventional pronouns, and work fewer hours to support my physical and mental health. I get to choose what clients I work with, who I spend time with, and what boundaries I need to set in order to keep the toxic expectations and hustle culture at bay. And I want that for you too. If you're ready to make your next big money move and build the financial foundations you need to feel like you can show up as your full self, I have an offer for you. My Generational Wealth Building Money Mentorship Program is 3 months of direct access to me and my brain to cut through all of the noise and conflicting information on the internet and get you where you need to be financially. Get a wealth building strategy, action plan, curated resources, and emotional support to put you on the path towards your abundant life. The link is in the show notes.
So I want to know, during this time when all of this was happening, what emotions were coming up for you?
Yeah. Emotions, like I was really sad about my grandma, and there were like some things, like sentimental items that I wanted from her house. So I would look for them and be like, oh, look at these memories and stuff like that. But those are probably the main ones. Like, I was annoyed with, like, my mom. But the rest, I think I was, like, really just observing how my family was handling it.
Yeah. And, like, what did that make you feel, though, that observation? Like, were there any gut reactions to it?
I think there was a lot of, like, curiosity and surprise. Because it's not just, like, when my family was sad, but it also, like, when they started sharing stories about, like, how they were in school. Like, how, like, my dad didn't do his homework and my uncle only got his homework done because my aunt would, like, sit with him and make him do it. And, like, those kinds of stories were very interesting to me. And then my dad turns around and was like, yeah, and that's why I couldn't be mad at your brother, because I could see myself in him and his behaviors with how school went. And I was like, God damn it, guys. Like, went through my whole life. And I want to say it's my brother instigated, like, a sibling rivalry thing, especially around, like, academics and achievements. And there was a lot of comparison happening. But, like, if I had known that there was, like, a genetic learning disability, because that was another thing of, like, I think it was either this trip or the one right before where my mom was like, no, your brother had, like, a diagnosed learning disability that we just didn't tell you about. And I was like, why don't you say these things to me? Because in my, like, teenage brain, I'm, like, trying to get your attention as much as you're giving to him and stuff like that. And, like, I would have felt completely different about it if I had understood that there was a fundamental reason.
Right. Exactly. It's almost as if the sibling rivalry is just a normal thing that they expect to happen, so they don't do anything to, you know, they probably don't even notice it, maybe.
No, I'm like, if I think about it, my mom is, like, purposely feeding the sibling rivalry, which is kind of like, there's, like, a using us to set goals for the other aspect to it. But at this point, as an adult, I'm, like, just resenting it. I'm like, why do you do this to us? Like, this is not cool.
Yeah. It's quite a common thing in the Asian culture, isn't it? Like, I'm talking South Asian, South African culture here, but I think playing siblings and cousins against each other was very normal in my family.
Yeah.
And actually seeing the parents compete with each other using their kids as well. Kids as little as, like, toddlers, there was a competitive tone of who walked first, who spoke first, what their child is doing.
Yes, absolutely. There's a book called The Joy Luck Club, and I don't remember much about it. I think we read it in, like, third grade or something. But that's basically the theme of, like, being an Asian American kid with parents who are constantly, like, boasting about their kids' trophies and stuff like that, and trying to live up to basically the version of social media highlight reel that was the Asian parent gossip train.
Oh my God, so true. So true, yes. And I think my mom probably got frustrated because she didn't have much to boast about with me.
Yeah, my mom told me this one time. She was like, oh, I ran into so-and-so's mom and their eldest daughter is an architect. And I was like, Mom. She was like, oh, well, I don't have anything like that to boast about you. I was like, yes, you do. You just didn't try hard enough to learn about it.
Oh, bless.
Because I was the youngest to get my certificate for project management in, like, my testing center. So I'm like, you just refuse to try. Like, it's convenient that architect is something everybody knows, but you have things to be proud of. You just don't know how to, first of all, look into them and be interested in the stuff I do accomplish and then explain it to someone else.
It has to be measurable on everyone's terms, doesn't it? Like, on the standard of what that measurement means, basically. Otherwise, it's not worth.
I mean, I think that's the gap or my resentment related to it is, like, you didn't even try, or, like,
yeah.
As a parent, you're supposed to care about things I'm into, not force me to be somebody I'm not.
But that's a great realization to have, because a lot of people walk through life, and, you know, myself as well, walk through life thinking that our achievements is our worth, because that's what we were taught. So it's really good to have that realization that your achievements mean to you whatever they want and look to you however you want them to look. It's not exactly what was ingrained in you growing up. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, success and achievement is not what the older generation made it out to be.
Yeah. And I will say there's also a gap too, because I don't think my parents were very good about the whole ingraining aspect of this, of the process. If they wanted like more of a drone, they didn't try hard enough, if I'm honest. Like,
I love that.
They kind of, they would say things like very rarely about what type of career or person I should marry and stuff like that. But the rest of like my understanding of my Asian culture or the expectations that might come with it actually come from other people's kids telling me about what their parents said. So if my parents wanted something out of this, they didn't try hard enough to brainwash me.
That's interesting and probably good, because it led you to your own part, didn't it?
Yeah.
All right. So let's come back to you coming back to your home and after experiencing all of this frustration and reflecting and observing and surprise and grief. Did anything come up for you about your own life after this experience? And what are you currently doing with that information?
Yeah. So when I came back, I knew I was sad. But when I talked to other people about like, oh, I'm still grieving or whatever it is, my brain is like, you're grieving, but it's not actually grieving grandma, because like we knew she was dying. So there was some pre-grieving that happened there and stuff. So it took me a while to figure out like, what am I actually grieving? And the realization I came to was that I'm sad and I'm crying about stuff because I'm grieving the concept that my family is like a healthy family unit, or that it was getting there, or it was like, I think being away from my family so much, I don't typically observe the dysfunctions, or I'm not subjected to the dysfunction of it. And somewhere in my like time away, especially like during COVID, I didn't go home except maybe once in those 3 years. I had like built a very healthy community for myself online with my friends here, in my work environments. Like, I'd gotten the type of community that I wanted. And then the contrast to what I had to like return to when I went home was so big, because it was like a sudden visit, right? Like when I went home for Christmas, it was where I could mentally prepare myself and be like, oh, if XYZ happens, this is how you're going to handle it. But for the funeral, because it was like, get on a plane this weekend, let's go. And I was processing grandma's death, right? Like I didn't have the grounding I needed to be ready for how dysfunctional it was going to be. And this was way more dysfunctional than it was over Christmas too. So what I ended up being sad about was that like coming to the terms with the concept of like, my family is broken and it's not going to fix itself. Like, because I think in the past few years, I was like, oh, like now that my both my parents are retired, there's a shift in dynamic and like things were kind of moving in a positive direction. But this like really was like taking the blindfold off and being like, no, this shit is like way deeper than that. And there's nothing I can do to influence it, right? Like I can influence my relationship individually with each person in my family and make that better. But what I was sad about was the concept of like, my mom couldn't support my dad and I can't influence their relationship. Even if I was like living closer and stuff, there's nothing I can do that is going to resolve that. And that's what I was most sad about. And then also like fundamentally realizing that, because my family's been like this since as early as I can remember, that there's been like my parents have been fighting, or that like my brother's resented the way that he's been parented and stuff like that, that all of my like lifelong mental health issues with like depression and anxiety and suicidal ideation stem from my family issues. And that's another thing to grieve, because it's like, because my family will never heal itself, what is my expectation of healing my mental health? Like, I'm never going to be 100% like mentally free of basically what I consider like a chronic illness at this point. And it's not that I expect it to be, but there's always this concept of like, when you have an illness, there should be a cure. And I'm like, if the cure is that my family figures their shit out, then that's never happening.
That's not in your control, is it? Like, you can't fix that.
It's not.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. So what is in my control is like how I come to terms with that reality of like how I accept it, and also realizing how that impacts my other relationships in my life, in terms of like the concept of me wanting to have my own family is based off of this like kind of, I hear it most often in orphans of like, well, they didn't have a family, so they want to start their own family. I was like, well, I have a broken family, so I'd like to build a like a healthy family. And it contributes to like my attachment style and how eager I am to be in a relationship or what I expect out of a relationship. And that is stuff that I have to like process and work through and be like, okay, is there places where I can detach those influences from the way I handle my relationships going forward? Because it's not something that I want to carry forward, of like a feeling of desperation to be in a stable relationship. I don't think it's going to change how much I want to be in a relationship. I definitely would love to like have kids and stuff. But if I could be in a more stable place myself, then I think that that's a better foundation for a healthy family than letting it be the way it is right now.
Yeah. Because even if you do find the perfect partner tomorrow, if you haven't learned yourself and learned how to have the best life with what you have been given, it's going to continuously show up in that relationship as well.
Yeah, there'll be subconscious aspects, right? Like if I can catch them now, or at least be aware of them, then even if I can't like do it all myself, I can have a conversation with my partner or my friends around me of like how to make it better.
100%. Yes. And that said, like conversation, communication, openly talking about these things, it's like, you know, you're taking off half that burden off your shoulder just by openly saying these things, right? We know we have this friend group on Facebook. None of us have met in person. Well, you've met Amandine.
Yeah, I have. Yes.
But none of us have otherwise met in person, but we've become so close. And I think I was thinking about this today, actually. I was thinking that like in this whole online world we've all been a part of as entrepreneurs, I found it very hard to connect to so many of these people on a fundamental, intense level. But what I have with us three, specifically us three, because we in that group still, what I have there is a place to go and talk in a way that I know whatever I say in this group, I'm not going to get jumped on.
There's no judgment. There might be a little bit of prodding, but there's
this prodding, but there's like 1,000% support there. And I know that. And I know like for me and you, we were just talking offline about it, but we have this art of catastrophizing, right? Which for the listeners, if you don't know what that means that when something happens, your brain jumps to the most worst possible scenario of how this thing is going to play off.
Yeah.
And not that it just stops there. It will fixate on that the entire time you're going through this process, which is really difficult to live in the moment when that happens to you. And we were talking offline about how there are some tools that we can actually use, you know, to get ourselves some clarity on a situation, right? But we were also saying how it's really hard to utilize those tools in the moment of going through the thing as well. Sometimes we just have to have that spew of emotions just coming out of us and just let it live and let live in that period of unease. Because if we never have that unease, what are we going to do with all the joy, right? Would you like to go into this amazing tool that my therapist taught me about? I think it was just yesterday.
Yeah. Walk us through it.
Okay, cool. So I'm quite excited about it because I just learned about it. But just like disclaimer to the audience, I'm not a therapist. I'm just repeating something my therapist told me. So, you know, bias, beware. And also it's just a tool that you can either, you know, it would either work for you or it won't work for you. We're going to experiment on it now with you, TJ. Right?
Yeah, let's do it.
And see what comes about. But basically, the theory is that we have different voices in our head or in our subconscious brain that reacts to different situations. And when we look at it from a helicopter view, so when we come out of the anxiety and the, you know, the feeling, the feels and the feeling frustrated in the moment, and we can actually come at it from a helicopter view of observation. We can actually reflect on what did our different parts of our brain or subconscious mind tell us about the situation? Which one was the loudest? Which one were we listening to? And what do the other parts have to say that we can give space for? So I'm going to explain the parts of the brain. So basically, if you picture it on a map, the middle part is the adult brain, right? Or the adult mind. Then you have your parent mind, which is one part is the controlling parent. So your controlling parent could be positive or negative. I would say most of the time, controlling parents have a negative impact on us. They can be positive, like don't touch the stove, look both ways before you cross the street, don't die. Pretty good controlling advice. But the negative would be things like trying to control your part in life, making decisions for you, giving you very little autonomy and choice in your life, being very strict on you. Then we have the nurturing parent brain, which is more of a positive influence. So the positive influence there would be someone telling you, you're enough, you're great, you're amazing. And TJ, like I was telling you, that's something we just didn't grow up with. And then we have the child brain. So there's two parts of the child brain. One is the adaptive child brain. And that's the one that is usually like a mask that we wear in society. And even with ourselves, most of the time we do it with ourselves, we don't even know that we're masking. But it's kind of the version of ourselves that needs to fit in, needs to play the good person, you know, needs to put up a brave face, basically. And then we have the child part of our brain, which is free, the free child side of our brain, which is the side of us who wants to, you know, play on the playground and say, fuck you to everyone else, because we just want to do what we want to do. We want to eat sand. We want to pee in the sand. We want to do whatever we want to. That's our child brain. And then the adult brain in the middle is the one that takes a more nuanced approach to all these voices and can actually make a logical, rational decision that's very balanced, I would say. Because each part of these subconscious minds give us something. It's just about finding the balance and understanding it and observing it, right? So I have like a small example of how I use this on myself in therapy. Would you like me to explain that, TJ?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So basically, I was triggered by a situation and that trigger had its own funnel that I went through. But I don't really want to talk about that trigger on the podcast. But the results of that trigger led my brain to go into this like catastrophizing spiral. As I'm currently on a job hunt and hopefully by the time this episode is released, I will be employed. But yeah, so I'm currently on a job hunt and the thing that happened led my brain into like this catastrophizing that, oh my God, I just learned something about myself. I learned that if I really am not truly passionate or invested in a task that I'm doing, I'm going to do a shit job. And what if I get a job that I'm not interested in? And what if I do a shit job and I start aspiring? Can I find a job I actually like? And like, I think for me, if I say, what I always say is that I say that my child brain's throwing a tantrum. This is what happens. Child's a tantrum. It's like, I want a perfect life. I want a perfect life now. Life is too hard. I don't want anything bad to happen ever. And it goes into that mode. And so my therapist said, okay, so what would the different parts of your brain say about the situation? So we went into the parent brain controlling would say, if I got a job that I didn't like, my parent controlling brain would say, Hannah, you got a job, you made a decision to be an adult and, you know, get a stable earning, you committed to this place, you got to stick it out, you're a grown-ass woman, controlling brain would say. Nurturing brain would be like, okay, Hannah, you are an adult, so it's your choice to decide what you want to do about this situation. You can stay if you want to, but if it gets really, really toxic and you know things are going to be bad, you have the choice to leave. You are a grown adult who has all this life experience behind you that knows how to make a good decision for yourself. The child adaptive brain will be very much under the controlling brain and following that, oh yes, I have to prove myself, do my best, show the world that I can do this job, even though I hate it. And the free brain would probably be wanting to swear every single person I work with and probably be doing that behind their back, to be honest.
Yep.
And then putting all these voices together, the adult brain can look and observe all these voices and be like, You got a point. You got a point. You got a point. You got a point. Let's see what we're going to take from all of this. What we can decide in this situation is that the controlling brain says I made a decision that I need to stick up. So what I'm going to take from that is I'm going to give myself a timeline that I realistically know I can tolerate to see this out and see how this plays out. But then I'm also going to take my nurturing brain's advice and just keep an eye on things that if they are too toxic and really unbearable, I will make a decision to leave. And the adaptive child brain, well, I think we're being a bit balanced here because we are sticking it out for a period of time. But then we have to just balance the adaptive child brain with the fuck you free child brain and be like, let's meet in the middle and be like, we can complain about our job to people outside of work, but let's not go tell the boss, fuck you right now. And let's just stay here for a monitored period of time. One thing I would say to the adaptive child brain is we don't need to prove to anyone that we can do anything because we fucking know that already.
Mm.
That's the big picture. So when I describe this funnel to you, what comes to your mind in this whole situation?
This funnel, I think, is big on how I handle my family dynamics in general, because if anyone was following me during the holidays, I was like, you know, it's okay to be like, basically, I was like, it's okay for child brain to be a thing, to like throw a tantrum and do whatever when you go to visit your family, especially for me that like, honestly, that's the most effective way I can get anything to happen in my family is that like the whole like Western culture, like active listening, like using I statements, like those conversations of like how to have a healthy disagreement. None of that exists in their nomenclature. I can try to use those arguments or use those techniques. They all fail because all they recognize is when I throw a tantrum, they're like, oh, now it's really important. Like me being like a completely adult in front of them is actually not underlining how like important something is, because it like Asians are like, well, you don't normally show emotions, so when you show emotions it must be important to you, right? Like, so
I love that.
So to me, the whole like exercising my child brain is my like, I don't want to have to live that way, right? Like, it's not good for anybody, like especially when you're trying to be an adult most of the time.
You can't do it all the time.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a space for it. There's a space for our child mind to love, to play, to come out. And maybe that's your space for it, 100%. You know, I hate using the word normal, but I think it's quite a common thing for all of us to revert to our childlike self around our parents.
Yes.
And there's lots of reasons for that because, like, you know, it's a survival thing as well. It worked all our life and it's continuing to work, so why stop? You know?
Yeah, they're very ingrained habits. And this is like something that I feel every time I go back of like, because I used to be a super picky eater and then I went to college and I decided that would be embarrassing, right? The child adaptive brain was like, oh, that would be embarrassing to be super picky in front of your college friends, so you should learn to eat more food. And then I would go home like that Christmas afterwards and go back to being picky. And I was like, oh, that just happened. Like that I was so used to like being catered to for of just eating the foods that I was used to as a kid that like, even though I learned to eat other foods, I still wanted to act like that when I went home. It was like very interesting to me.
I love that.
So things like that.
It's like, let's see how much attention I can get.
Yeah. Things like that come up for me all the time. And then the other aspect is like there's an aspect of being the child of immigrants of sometimes feeling like I have to be the parent in the situation and having to decide, like basically sort through all my options and be like, is this when I throw a tantrum or is this when I confront them about like what a healthy interaction would look like? Or do I just like let it go and walk away because it's not worth it?
You know what I find interesting here, TJ, is that you use this formula in a way to think about how you interact with your family and how you interact with other people. But I'd be interested in how would you use this to your own life situation rather than how I'm around people? Because I think being our child self around certain people or being adaptive around certain people is that itself, yes, definitely something that we can think about and say why we do it. But what would we do when we're saying like, oh, I'm very desperate to find a relationship to build a family? What would that look like on the funnel?
I think maybe controlling parent brain would be a lot more of the traditional concepts of what it is to have a family. And actually a lot of like timeline wise, I'm 32 now, and like the whole biological ticking clock.
You should be married.
Yeah, like those things are like, because, you know, with like family asking, like, do you have a boyfriend and stuff? And that influence comes in from the parent controlling brain.
So-and-so is married and you not.
Yeah.
He has 3 children and you don't.
Yeah. And then from a parent nurturing side, I think it's like, oh, it'll happen when it happens, or like you have to find the right person. You can't just marry anybody, right? Like there's the like, just do it and make it happen versus the like, it has to be good for you aspect.
Yeah. And I mean, are you asking yourself in that brain, is this space for, do I love myself? Am I ready for this? Are you ready for this? You know, is this right for you right now?
Yeah. That's been a struggle of like, am I ready for this? It's kind of like, I went through the whole pandemic single and tried to figure that out. And the only answer I really have is like, I'm not going to know until I get back into it of like having a true relationship and working it out. Cause it's going to be different with every person. So I can't like pre-write myself a script of how things are supposed to happen until I meet the person that I'm going to make it work with.
So it's like, let it happen organically is more what your nurturing parent brain is trying to tell you. Like, let it unfold organically, let it happen.
Yeah. Like there's this bit of like, you just got to be open, right? Like you don't put too many constraints or requirements on a relationship. Like the adapting brain is just like, it is what it is deal of like, I'm trying and it'll like,
at least I'm trying.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least I'm trying.
I've hired a matchmaker. I'm on the dating apps. I'm trying to go out more in person to meet people. Like it's,
no one can say I'm not doing the things.
Yeah. Cause I am trying, guys, and it sucks. And there's a lot of me like brushing off how bad it is too. In terms of just like the dating environment these days, so stupid.
yes, we get all the updates.
Yeah,
love it.
My friends get screenshots of shit. It's just, I think the drama is fun to share.
It is.
And then child brain is like, I think there's two aspects of child brain. It's kind of like, can I just not, I guess, and like not put in this much effort to make something happen, or like, when I sense that somebody I'm going to go meet isn't putting in a lot of their effort, then I'm like, well, I'm going to match it. I'm going to like forget this. I'm like, I'm only going to put in as much energy as you are, that kind of thing. And somewhere in there, and I don't know where, in which category it goes, there's the aspect of like, I mentioned, I want kids. I'm like, I think what it is that parent controlling brain is saying, I can't take this option, but technically there is an option where I just adopt a child and forget the whole spouse aspect of the situation.
Well, that's a whole other question, isn't it? Because I guess then you have to think about, what is it that you're looking for? Are you looking for a relationship? Are you looking for family? What does family mean to you?
Yes, there's so much to it.
So much, yeah.
Because I think the controlling in the child brain are kind of like, well, but it would be easier with a partner, or you'd have to do less with, and like, there's all those aspects.
Well, it's interesting that you look at having a partner as a tool for helping you with a kid.
You know, and that this is why it fundamentally goes back to like my issue with my family, is that the reason my parents aren't divorced is because my mom didn't think that she would like make enough to support us. At least in my head, we didn't like explicitly talk about it. But if she had gotten divorced, because she had mentioned it one time when I was super little, is that like she would take the kids with. But at the time she was working like a part-time teaching assistant job. So that was making like $17 an hour at her peak, and it was part-time. So that wouldn't have been enough in California to support us financially. So to me, there's an aspect of family that says, oh, having a partner makes you more financially stable, or it makes it easier to split expenses, which is part of why I have a roommate. I gain a lot of those same benefits by having a roommate right now. So there is a ingrained association in me that family includes emotional and financial stability, and doing it on my own to have a kid is, will feed part of my like urge to like have a nurturing situation and have like a familial bond, but it will not give me the stability aspect.
Yeah. it seems like your parents' nurturing brain is really craving a lot of attention or somewhere to put that.
Yeah, yeah. There's like something in there that needs that.
Yeah.
So that's like the breakdown. And then as the adult brain, just trying to balance it of like, well, I can prove to myself that I'm doing something, but that like my roommate asked me, where are you from one to desperate for this one guy you're like talking to work out? And I'm like, well, if you only give me one or desperate on this scale, I guess I'm a one. Like, I'm not just going to take whoever.
Yeah, that's like a slim scale. What's in between one and desperate? Is he like thinking one is one and desperate is 10, one is one and desperate is 100?
I mean, that's part of the joke, right?
What is this ratio?
He didn't mean it to be a real scale. He was just pointing out that if I like forced it, it would be desperate.
Right. So there's only two Moses. Either you don't want it or you want it.
Yep.
Nice. I like it. I think we can like go on so much into this, but I think that this is a good place to kind of like end on, because I think that seeing your journey going from grieving to witnessing your family and, can I say, being triggered? Is that the right word to use? Maybe realizing more, like realizing how much of yourself you need to, you know, do the work on, basically, you know, and come to, you know, there's gaps that need to be filled, and you're kind of like piecing it all together now, right? I think it's such a powerful thing to go through all of this and, you know, be in that state of observation and give yourself this time of reflecting and being like, okay, I'm doing all the things, like you said, but you also understand that while doing all the things, there's still work that needs to be done along the way. And I mean, that's all we can do as humans, right? We can't fix everything instantly.
No.
As much as we want to. Child brain tantrum. We want the answers now.
Just be fine. Ah.
All this work is so much of work. Adulting is hard.
Yes, yes.
Oh, fuck. But is there any final words you want to say to wrap this up, TJ?
I guess to me, like, the whole sharing of this story was kind of to say that, like, to provide some representation that, because growing up in America, clearly I went home with some kind of expectation of how, like, the grieving process would look, and it didn't look like that for me. So I want people to know that, like, maybe if it hasn't happened to you yet, to be a little bit mentally prepared. And if it has happened to you, that you're not alone, that it, like, it doesn't match what media told us it's supposed to look like, especially specifically for non-white Americans. Like, I'm just going to like to add that level of broadness there. And I definitely want to thank you, Hannah, for helping me talk through this, because this was like, honestly struggled a lot to like pull out what exactly I wanted to share about this or why it was important for me to share. So I really appreciate you coming on to interview me about it.
Yeah, of course. I want to say it was fun, but that seems like it shouldn't be fun to do that.
We're friends. This is it's, everything is fun with us.
Okay, good.
I know that something in this episode left you feeling, oh my God, that's so me. And I want to hear about it. Leave a review on iTunes or tag me on social media and share your relatable story with us so that we can normalize our experiences as Asian Americans and help more people feel safe to step outside of the box. I can't wait to hear about it. You can find me on Instagram at tj.wey, and don't forget to design your abundant life.